I have a dream.
One small step.
Oh, my, what do you say?
The wall must go.
China, Princess of Wales.
Right into the World Trade Center.
Winner is Sydney.
This week in history.
And tonight we're heading back to the early days of the English colony of Virginia and the settlement of Jamestown. As children, many of us have read about Jamestown in the story of Pocahontas and John Smith. And it'll come as no surprise that the Disney version takes more than a few historical liberties. But it's still fair to say that the pair did play a role in keeping something of a peace between the colonists and the local Powhatan Indians, for a time at least. That peace ended, though, in 1622, when on this day, on the 22nd of March, the Jamestown colony came under attack. What happened next is a story that is continuing to be unearthed. And one of the researchers delving into it is David Givens. He's the Director of Archaeology at the Jamestown Rediscovery Project and joins us now on Skype from Virginia. Good morning, David.
Good morning. How are you?
I am very well, thank you. Very well. Maybe we should start with a bit of background on Jamestown itself, David. It represented a pretty significant step in the British colonisation of the Americas, didn't it?
It did. It was the first permanent settlement here in English North America, and largely was the first attempt by the British to have a transatlantic settlement. And it was our nation's first corporation, actually.
Right. And can you describe that early Jamestown settlement for us? What was it like in those early years?
Well, it was the edge of the world for the English. And we know from the archaeology, which differs from history in that it's the material evidence that's in the ground, that they were scared. You know, they brought with them, of course, there was a military venture, but we've also dug up items like anti-witch devices that we've discovered through working with researchers in England.
Oh, what does an anti-witch device look like?
Well, it's quite surprising. Actually, we found these jet crucifixes. They're a stone that is light coal, lignite, and it's a precious stone, but it was these very sort of Catholic crucifixes, and we were confused because it was a Protestant colony, and doing research, we found that they were meant to be nailed over the hearth to keep witches from coming down the chimney. So we know, although this is the beginning of the age of science and discovery, that they were still thinking the world had witches and mermaids and things like that.
And the location wasn't quite ideal, was it, David?
No, it's actually very low-lying. But to the colonists, they were following a couple things. One, the directions from the company, the Virginia Company, told them not to settle where there were any Indians between their fort and the ocean because those people could be used against them. The other factor was that John Smith and Edward Maria Wingfield, who were part of the leadership group, had an argument. And Maria Wingfield was told by the company not to build a fort because the Indians would know they were there to stay. And Smith said, look, if we don't build a fort, or as we say in modern parlance, a wall, right, build a wall, we're going to get overrun. Now, Smith won out because they were attacked, and he became very popular with the men. And you know Smith's name, you probably don't know Edward Maria Wingfield.
No, that's true.
Right. Now, he's the one who built the fort, the Triangle, because he was a veteran soldier from fighting the Spanish in the lowlands. And he knew a triangle on the form of land that Jamestown is perfect for 104 people. It's the most defensible angles. Triangles cover each angle with gunfire from, cannons from each corner. There's no blind spots, and that tells us that this guy knew what he was doing. Now, of course, history tells a different story, though, right?
Yeah, and the landscape, though, wasn't very conducive, was it? It's swampy and isolated.
It is. There's no water, per se. you can't drink. There's a swamp in the back, and the river is brackish at different times of the year. And as we have found over the past 25 years of archaeology, that history is complicated. You can't just blame one thing or another. And so at times of the year, you can drink the river water. It's fresh. And other times, it's very salty. And the times that it's salty in the fall, when it stops raining, is when they started dying initially. And so that just typifies the sort of misunderstanding of the myth about the place over time, but which archaeology sheds a new light.
And in this first group of arrivals, there were only men and no women. What effect did that have on the fort?
Well, it was a military venture, and I think people often forget about that. I refer to the first 104 as colonial marines. But the myth is, and I've got kids and I deal with this all the time, they're taking tests in school and they come to me and say, "Dad, it says women didn't arrive until 1620. And I have to say, "Look, your book is wrong. The first women arrive in 1608, Mistress Forrest. 1609, we have Jane, the young lady who was cannibalized." I mean, it's just oftentimes I find that it's absolutely appalling how wrong we are about history.
Particularly this story in history, I find it quite fascinating. Now, what do we know, David, about the local Indian population that was already living in the region?
Well, we had a 14 to 15,000 Virginia Indians living in the Chesapeake, or in proximity to the fortification and those villages, if you will, for lack of a better word, had been amalgamated under a single ruler. And the English had intentionally placed their fort in the core, the center of that nation, so that they could get food and information and get a good foothold in settlement.
Right. And how did the Indians, did they go along with that relationship and supply them with goods?
Well, the first thing that happens is there's, of course, as I mentioned, they're attacked. More of a skirmish in which we know a couple of young boys die. And when I say boys, they're 15, 16 years old. And that triggers the construction of the fort. Now, the Paspahe, who are the closest tribe to the fortification, they had attacked, but then had gotten word from Powhatan to back off. And that's when the relationship starts between the English and the Indians in a real sort of ambassador type way.
And probably most well-known of these early colonists was John Smith, as you mentioned before. What role did he actually play in keeping the peace between the Powhatan Indians and the settlement in those early days of Jamestown?
Well, he was initially captured while exploring upriver to the west and taken to Powhatan. And one of the first things that he does when he's given an opportunity to, speak in a way, is that he pulls out a compass sundial, which is how they navigated back then. And he shows the Indians that the north arrow on the needle, he says the fly of the needle points to the north. And he said that they were amazed by that. And at that point, I think that Opekankanu's Wahun Seneca's brother, Opekankanu, realized that this guy had information. And just as today, information is power. And they took him to Werowocomoco, lack of a better word, the capital town of the Powhatan or the Algonquins in our area.
So did John Smith become a type of ambassador to the Indians?
He did. There was a ceremony in which he was to be killed, and at the last moment, as we know from Disney or whatever
yeah.
history you've read, Pocahontas steps in and stops that. Now, we as anthropologists see that as an adoption ceremony, or I think it's saving face, just like in any European play, any Shakespearean play, the daughter of the king gets between the man who is demanding his death, Powhatan's brother, Opekankanu, and politics, right? Information and power. And so the only way to save face is to have somebody who's an intermediary step in. And, you know, that's the, if we don't view it in that light, we're downplaying the political savviness of the local Virginia Indians. And from that point on, Smith became the sole ambassador, essentially, until he leaves the colony in 1609, and things go pretty well.
You're listening to Nightlife with Indira Naidoo, and we're doing our This Day in History, focusing on the Powhatan attacks of 1622 in Virginia. And I'm talking to David Givens, who's the Director of Archaeology at the Jamestown Rediscovery Project. David, you mentioned Pocahontas earlier, and we could just do a whole conversation just on her. But just briefly, what was John Smith's relationship with her? Many of the popular stories portray it as romantic.
Well, that often drives us crazy as researchers because, you know, although she was very young, we don't know what was going on back then, but certainly the reality was that if you position the Powhatan Indians, and I'll use that term again for lack of a better term, the Senecomicans, but if you position the Indians in a very elite political structure in which they're having to maintain their boundaries within other native cultures in Virginia, North Carolina, to Maryland to the north, then things start to make sense. And that's the way we view Smith. That's the way we view Pocahontas and her eventual marriage is a political one in which we don't even think twice about the English marrying Spanish, the elite, the kings and queens, princes, princesses marrying within political structures to solidify, right? So if you look at it from that sense, that position, that makes total sense and one that's more realistic than a love story.
And when did things start to deteriorate between the colonists and the Powhatan Indians?
Well, there's a number of compounding issues. Like I said, history is often generalized out of necessity. But what the archaeology has shown us is that it was the worst drought in 770 years when the colonists arrived. So everyone was on edge with food and things like that. Then again, Smith gets burned. He has a powder burn while out exploring on a ship. Some people think that was an intentional act. Somebody lit his powder bag on fire. We just don't know. It's history. But once he has to return to England, the colony resorts to violence to extract food from the local population. Of course, that doesn't go well. Things degrade, and Powhatan has to put his foot down. And they attack the fort in the winter of 1609 and 10. And they're sequestered, the colonists are sequestered in the fort. Meanwhile, there was a resupply mission to the colony to give it a good one more strong push as things were rough, and that gets shipwrecked on Bermuda, and those people don't arrive until the spring of 1610.
Right, and Pocahontas was captured during this time?
She was taken from actually the Potawatomi village, which is up in the Chesapeake, as a leverage against Powhatan, and brought to the fortification. And there she, of course, learns English, converts to Christianity, and eventually marries John Rolfe.
So this was many years before the attack of 1622. What kind of efforts were made to live peacefully after this 1610 incident? How successful were they?
Well, up until the marriage of John Rolfe and Pocahontas, which was 1614, everything that I've said to you in the interview today is predication. So everything is building towards 1622. The next piece of the puzzle is that John Rolfe, who was shipwrecked on Bermuda, we now know that he acquires Spanish tobacco there, tobacco seeds. He brings it to Virginia and certainly is working with Virginia Indians to hybridize our Virginia tobacco, which people don't really know about, which is a very small leaf and strong and harsh tobacco, with this mild Spanish tobacco, and that becomes our number one export from 1613 to 2005 in Virginia. And once the marriage takes place in 1614, that stops the Anglo-Powhatan War, the violence, and the colonists are allowed to start spreading out into the frontier. So they slowly are pushing and pushing, pushing back on the Indians, and that is one of the key factors of 1622.
Right, so that's when things started to boil over, those long simmering tensions. Other than that colonist expansion, what were the other triggers for the 1622 attack?
Well, like I said, the colonists had, the quote that we use often is they were growing tobacco in the streets. So they were running out of land, and so they eventually are pushing out further and further into land that isn't theirs, and treaties had been signed. John Rolfe was particularly instrumental in signing treaties with the local tribes, the Chickahominies, the Paspahe, and others, and those treaties are violated, and that's the main pushing into the frontier is the main trigger for that 1622 massacre.
Right. So, David, take us through what actually happened during the attack.
Well, for Jamestown, they had a warning. So there was a young boy, Chanko, that came about. Opie Kankanoo, Powhatan's brother. So the local Virginia Indians are matrilineal. So Powhatan's brother, is a brother from another mother. So he has a separate mother from the Pamunkey tribe, actually. Is Pocahontas' mother as well. And what happens is Opie Kankanoo had taken a more strong line in his politics against the English and a penchant for violence. And his personal assistant or advisor, Nemantnu, was killed very shortly before the massacre. And that, I think that was the final straw in the coffin. And so what ended up happening from the documents is that the colonists described the Virginia Indians coming into their settlements, which was normal for trade and communication and other things. And that they acted very peacefully and then picked up their own tools and attacked the colonists, and hundreds were killed throughout Virginia.
And are there many first-hand accounts, David, about that attack? And how do they describe it? Was it bloody?
It was. I mean, their attempt was to wipe out the English completely in the colony. Now, that wasn't new to the Algonquins in the history of our area. They had done that in the 1570s to a Spanish Jesuit mission that was here, the exact same M.O., if you will. They walked in, agreed to help them build a mission, and then picked up the tools and slaughtered the Jesuits. In this case, there were many, many outlying settlements at this time. There had been 11 parishes and fortifications and plantations throughout the colony. And they just came in and essentially wiped out all of those except for in fortifications like Jamestown, which had gotten a warning prior to the attack.
So how did the colonists retaliate?
Well, the subsequent political action by the Crown Colony. So soon after the attack, by 1624-25, we become a royal crown colony. They take a much harder line against Virginia Indians. Eventually, Native Americans are put on reservations. That's something I think the world doesn't know. especially when they visit Jamestown, is that the Virginia Indians have been on reservations since the 17th century, and you don't hear about that. You sort of hear about reservations in the West, the Sioux and the Navajo, et cetera. But here in Virginia, they signed treaties with the Crown, and so when we became the United States, they got forgotten. And so our Indian population here in Virginia has agreements and treaties signed since the 17th century, and they had been keeping up their end continually since that time of honoring the treaties and the terms.
Okay, but did relations ever recover from this attack?
I would say no. Many of my friends are Virginia Indians. Some of my friends have gone to school at the local university and gotten PhDs. And in working with them and thinking about who we are and what we find in our fortification, our excavations here, there's a lot of anger. There's still a lot of anger. Our Virginia Indian community only got federal recognition just a few years ago. And they had state recognition, but not federal, and that was a true crime. It's just absolutely abhorrent that they now are an independent nation within the United States, each tribe, and that's the way it should have been all along.
And the way it's viewed, David, this Powhatan attack or the Jamestown massacre, that the way it's framed and the labels that it gets, is that changing?
Well, unfortunately, it's not. And I think that we as researchers struggle with that those terms, whether you say uprising or attack. History, the victors are the ones who write history. And it's just something that we struggle with, and I don't have any good term. I use uprising or attack, but certainly the Virginia Indians had good right as their land was being taken away.
So how would you like this day in history to be remembered?
Well, the fort here at Jamestown, And folks can come visit our museum and see, is almost more of a Virginia Indian site in material culture, in other words, artifacts, than it is English. And it's absolutely phenomenal. And the story of the first few years of our nation here, if Jamestown is seen as the beginning, is one of interaction and exchange of technology, decorative arts, and It's clear that the English are living within what I'll say is the first people's space. And that first space is one that just isn't recognized. And it's high time, and something we celebrate in our museum, this beginning of a third space in which we become American. And so we actually, through archaeology, can show that. And there's a strange connection between Australia and the archaeology that you guys have and that we have, and that they're very parallel, in which first peoples are incorporating technology that they're exposed to, and the English, when they arrive, are incorporating technology, foodways of the first peoples. And so that moment in which neither side is quite sure. Right, it's the moment before the hegemonic domination of the English that is played out in the archaeology of James Fort in those first 3 years. And that's an important story to tell. It's not Pocahontas. It's not Disney. It's real people trying to hammer it out. Unfortunately, violence is always the end of the colonialism around the world with the empire, the English Empire. But there's a moment in which that event horizon in which the two come together, and it's just absolutely fascinating and something that we commemorate here at the fort.
And is there much more work for you to do with this particular time in history in terms of the artifacts that you can unearth?
Oh, absolutely. 2019, last year, was the 400th anniversary of representative government. So in 1619, we had our first democratic experiment at Jamestown, and 3 weeks later, the first Angolans or Africans arrived into our colony. And the archaeology of diversity with Africans, Virginia Indians, and the English is wide open. We focused essentially on 2 acres of James Fort for the last 25 years, and there's 40 acres of what's called Jamestown, and then eventually James City, in which these first Africans were brought in. And it's interesting because the massacre triggered the Crown to order an accounting of all people, animals, property within the colony, a muster. And in that muster is the only evidence we have of the arrival of these Africans and where they are within the colony.
Ah, so still more work ahead for you, David.
Oh, absolutely. It'll be beyond my lifetime. And it's a phenomenal time to be alive.
Terrific, David. Thank you so much for joining us tonight for this day in history, the Powhatan attacks of 1622. David Given is the Director of Archaeology at the Jamestown Rediscovery Project.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.